shooting out sparks over 38 states, the Canadian Plains, and the tequila fields of Mexico.
A program most deserving of a grand introduction.
The Nocturnal Journal.
The Talk of the Town. WGN Radio 720.
With your guide, Dave Hoekstra.
Daytime turns me off and I don't mean maybe. 9 to 5 ain't taking me where I'm bound.
Welcome to this weekend's edition of the Nocturnal Journal. And I'm Dave Hoekstra here with producer Dan Long. And we like to think this is like a little living room for us. We invite all kinds of people in, like a little bachelor pad, right, Dan? Right here,
if you want to call it that,
on a Saturday night. So after last Saturday night, I go to the Matchbox to wind down for a couple beers, and I run into my friend Dennis Kamelik, who's here in the studio.
Good evening, Dave. Good to see you. My
How
friend.
Are you? So you come up, we start talking. You start talking about we're going to go this week to the American Philosophical Association convention. And you just got back from
the Central Division meeting.
Is at the Palmer House.
It's at the Palmer House this year. Last year it was in St. Louis. It usually tends to be in Chicago.
And Dennis, I mean, we were talking. I mean, I had no idea what you were talking about Saturday night.
I just got off work, and this is so far removed from my day job. It's my opportunity to get back to recharge my academic batteries. And to quote Frank Morgan from The Wizard of Oz, my opportunity to hobnob with my fellow wizards. I started to say, oh, there's going to be a fantastic explanation of cognitive neuroscience and mathematical constructs for the predictability of thought patterns. And you're going, what? Do you want to come on the show and talk about this?
Yeah, this is fascinating.
And I said, why?
This is what Dan and I are all about.
But no, as a matter of fact, today I looked at something. I showed up to Palmer House, and the great thing about being in the city, where you can buy all these books and stuff and trinkets, and you don't have to worry about putting them in your luggage. You just take them home on the Red Line. But I was looking at something today, and who is this philosophy of sport? I was like, what the heck is that? And I go in, and nobody's attending. And so zero people. So I walk in, and I just joked with the speaker and the moderator, and I said, is this the philosophy of horticulture? They said, no. I said, good, then I'm in the right place. And so they said, just pull up a chair at the speaker's dais, and we just kicked this thing around from the economy of sport to the physiology of sport. What makes sport different from game? What about collegiate athletics? What does that do to academic standard? What does it do against academic standard? What are some of the downsides, the upsides of professional sport? How does it benefit a city to have a sports franchise? We just covered the whole gamut, just kicking it around. And it was so much fun.
Who all goes to the American Philosophical Association? Are people from all over the country or the world?
The members are usually professors, researchers, grad students, and then idiots like me.
Is there a screening? Is there a screening process? Like, could Dan and I go?
You probably could.
Yeah,
you fall asleep during that. But it's really, this is the central division of the APA. It's a national organization, and I've run into people from the University of Bern. It's not just limited to like Michigan State, Notre Dame, and the Central St. Louis University. Those people are clearly there. But you'll find them coming from the East and the West. They would go, there's a Pacific Division meeting, there's an East Coast Division meeting, there's a Central
Division.
Are
they teachers? Are they scholars? Are they writers?
By and large, yes. They're teachers, scholars, professors, researchers, as I say, grad students. And increasingly we're seeing grad students deliver the papers, and then they're given a travel stipend so that they can actually come and present their work, and we criticize them or applaud them, or as the case may be. Some really interesting things going on with from philosophy students and professors in every, I tell you, like I was saying earlier, there's a philosophy of literature. There's probably a philosophy of lampshades for all we know. There's philosophy of literature, philosophy of science. I was talking in the green room to somebody asking, what about philosophy of science? And I was just talking about verisimilitude and falsifiability. What does that mean? You can falsify a statement. Let's say water boils at 100 degrees centigrade. And then you say to me, well, Dennis, if you take your water up 1,000 meters up a mountain, it's not going to boil at 100 degrees centigrade. Okay. So I am going to take my water, I'm going to put a lid on this thing. Oh, Dennis, if you put a lid on that, it's not going to boil at 100 degrees centigrade. So I alter my statement. I'm not making it more false or more true, but I'm going to finally say water in a vessel, uncovered, heated to a constant temperature of 100 degrees at sea level will have a tendency to boil.
So this goes on throughout the convention.
This kind of thing does.
Yeah. And when did the convention start?
Wednesday afternoon.
And it wrapped up today.
Saturday evening, yeah.
And what do people do at night? Do you guys all go out? Do you go to the Matchbox, Gibson's?
Right, yeah. I go home.
You go home?
But when I'm in St. Louis, yeah, I go out with them. But a lot of them will end up at, and can I mention, you know, Miller's or B&B's?
Yeah, well, that's close
right
to the Palmer House.
Or the Palmer House Bar, which there's another one. There's a Potter's Bar now in a restaurant in the Palmer House. Meet a lot of people there. And sometimes that's some of the best. Alcohol and philosophy mix very, very well, I would have to say. And you got to find some of the best tete-a-tete rehashing things. I was talking about a lab experiment a couple of years ago with some fellow from Carnegie Mellon, and fascinated about what he was able to discern about how you can predict a thought pattern before the thought actually takes place. He's actually got a lab experiment with this.
How do you do that?
Going on. The short answer is I don't know. The long answer is we don't have enough time.
It'd be good to know. Good to know for us. How did you get into this? I don't know you that well. I know you, you know, through the journalism stuff.
A lot of people don't know this, but I did get a terminal degree. That sounds bad. I got a PhD, is what that means.
Yeah.
In philosophy, many, many years ago.
Where'd you get that at?
I was a student in Rome and at the Gregorian University. And that's where I got my master's and doctorate way back in the late 80s and early 90s, I should say. I've taught some, the community colleges, Roosevelt University, and different places around the area, write some. But it's something that I don't usually get the chance to exercise unless I attend one of these conferences.
When you pursue a degree like that, what is the end game? I mean, do you want to teach? I mean, it's kind of it's kind of obtuse to have a degree like that. How do you make it work in the real world?
In the real world, you'd end up teaching or research. Yeah. Here is an example. Philosophers are not always just teaching and researching. A long time ago, I was teaching grade school. There was a young man in the class, an 11-year-old by the name of Pete McMurray, whom some listeners might remember. And the Iranian embassy had been overcome by and people were held hostage. The United States was going to look for worldwide condemnation of this event. And then if that didn't work, sanctions against Iran. How do you do that? Now, if your kid's a teenager and they say, we're going to shun my friend because he said something about somebody's girlfriend and we're not all going to talk to him. And you would say, that's bad behavior. Well, how do adults do that? Because it's essentially what they were doing in Iran. I called the congressman at the time and there was a philosopher on staff. And he said to me then, he said, well, I would look up this book. It was called Law and Minimum Public Order. And there was another one on the different degrees that are recognized for the ethics of international relations. And I presented this to the kids, and we were able to sort this out. Where would the United States or Britain or any of these NATO nations, where would they go next? Where are they like? And, you know, those kids were on the cutting edge of that story at the time because we had consulted a philosopher in Congress.
That's Dan, I feel like Milt Rosenberg here.
You look like Milt Rosenberg.
I don't know
about
that.
Whom my mother always called Mort Rosenthal. I don't know why. She would always get names backwards.
Now, this is the 113th annual
meeting. And I've been to every one of them.
Yeah, well, I want to kind of gauge like where the community at. I mean, how many people were at this one? Is attendance on the wane? Are there more, you know, were there more years ago? What's the philosophy?
Annually, there's like about 1,400 that attend this thing. What I'm noticing about what's on the wane, which is good and bad, I'm missing some of my buddies whom I hang out with, and because they're in emeritus status now, they're my age. And so sometimes with universities, you only get one travel stipend. You can only go to one event a year. And so either they teach in Chicago and then they can attend this, or they don't show up. But the other side of that, there are younger and younger grad students and assistant associate professors that are coming up, and they're very interesting to see where they're going with this.
How are younger philosophers, how does their approach How is that different than older philosophers?
Well, because the issues are different. Okay. There's more feminism. There is more intercultural understanding. The business ethics, professional ethics. They're looking into the justifiability, for example, of can a corporation be a person pursuant to the recent Supreme Court decision.
Uh-huh.
And someone was presenting a paper on Stevens' dissent for that. And I kind of got into it with that person as she was presenting. And then afterwards, over wine and cheese, the talk continues. It's just a fascinating world of conversation advancing, advancing the conversation. Philosophy is indeed a kind of, it's the search, it's the quest for truth, it's the love of wisdom, the pursuit of wisdom, and the quest for knowledge. And every time you open your mouth and open your ears, you're going to learn something.
Is that harder to do today with so much noise? I mean, noise of social media, noise of just, there's noise everywhere.
Yeah.
I think of philosophy as just kind of a quiet, reflective thing. Is it harder to do it with
there's
so much?
Probably, I can tell you this, there is a philosophy of the media.
Tell us about that.
Well, you're looking at the influence of the media on a culture, or the influence of the culture on the media, or vice versa. Which came first, the chicken or the egg kind of thing? But you're also looking at an analysis of a social dynamic and how it expresses itself epistemically. Epistemic. How you express your knowledge. Epistis is the Greek word for to know, for knowledge. So epistemology is the study of knowledge, the study of how we know. So there is an epistemological reference point in how we express our news, how we gather our news, how we share it, how we are going to develop our reaction to this. It's going to snow tomorrow, I'm going to put on my boots. From that to whatever the Kardashians, whatever they might be doing at this time or another time. What does that say about us? Yeah. So media is a very hot button issue in philosophy.
All right, we're going to take a break here, then I'm going to have you handicap what was the hot subjects at the convention this year.
Okay.
So don't go away on Nocturnal Journal. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal here on WGN 720. It's not often we have a philosopher on the show, right, Dan? Any questions for our philosopher guest?
Actually, yeah. Before we kind of get back into the serious type of subject matter, you mentioned kind of at the beginning you're picking up trinkets. What kind of trinkets could you possibly pick up at a philosophical convention?
Oh, there's all kinds of swag. The ballpoint pens, the thumb drives, these little rubber band wristbands, post-it notes.
So it's not like Socrates action figures or anything.
As a matter of fact, yeah. Well, there was a Kant a post-it note with little colored tabs that you can actually mark pages with. Very esoteric.
Excellent.
Fun stuff, Dan.
That's good. So you said we were talking the philosophy of sport. Nobody was at that one.
No.
What were the popular ones? What did people?
The hot button issues will vary, from time to time. I know that property rights was a private property, nature of private property. There was something I was looking for one on. The only reason I went there was a friend of mine from Purdue was chairing it, and I told him, he says, at the end of the conference, nobody's going to be there. I said, Bill, I'll go. Professor Bill McBride, if you're listening, he's on his way back to West Lafayette. That was on, I've forgotten what it was, but I remember the talk was given by a grad student, and it didn't seem like it held water. I didn't say anything at the time, but Bill was kind enough to point out to the young lady presenting it that it doesn't look like this is connected to that. Your sequence is a little off, but good paper by and large. There was something on Socratic dialogue. I dropped in on that one instead. I went to the wrong room. That looked like it was full of people, which is really strange for a Saturday afternoon. But no, the biggies tend to be right now. They're either very scientific, like the cognitive neuroscience stuff and mathematical constructs and all of that, or they're very hot button moral and social issues.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask.
Feminism this, race-based so on, urban violence, again, the private property, construction.
Urban violence, like what do they talk about urban violence?
Well, that wasn't so much this year, but St. Louis last year, there was a fair bit about that and the origin of race, race as a metaphor, race as a vehicle for expression and also a vehicle for division, which is a social reality, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. I'm sorry if I'm misquoting that, but again, this is from last year. And the great thing about this is, that what I mean, the whole coming together, is everybody's name and email address, and you can contact these people, and you can email, hey, Bill, Jack, Jane, whomever. I really enjoyed this, but I didn't have time to ask you this, but could we stay in touch here, and can you elucidate more what you meant by the racial this or the feminist that and whatever? So it's an ongoing, again, like I said, it's the great conversation University of Chicago professor, which is, I can't remember now, How to Read a Book, was it said, Mortimer Adler, as you say, called it the philosophy of the great conversation.
Yeah. I asked you to send me some notes. You said you left the religious community. What community was that again?
That is the Rosminian Fathers Institute of Charity. I was in the community for 30 years. Left about 25 some years ago.
And can I ask what your decision was to leave?
I felt that the ministry should be directed more to bringing the lay people who were close to the order but not fully professed, to train them to start taking on some of the work that priests don't necessarily have to do, that eventually lay people can and should do all the things that you're going to get me in trouble here.
That's what it's all about.
That's what it's all about. can and should take on the role of ministry and not necessarily be ordained by a bishop in order to take on those roles.
Well, the reason I asked that question was that a hard decision? That had to be a hard decision.
You're in something for 30 years.
Yeah.
I went to a psychologist. I spent 2 or 3 years in transition, you know, agonizing over this.
Well, and did your background in philosophy, did that inform the decision? Did that inform the transition? I mean, how did it?
Well, it was 25 years ago, yeah. So I was working on my doctoral dissertation, and so at that time it was more of an added pressure and distraction than anything else. So the background, yeah, it helped you analyze things and look at it rationally, but at the same time there was just so much pressure going on at the time that's something I would not want anyone to to experience. I certainly wouldn't want to relive it.
Where's the convention next year?
I don't know, as a matter of fact. Yeah. I want to find out. I hope it's here.
You know, do they have it in Chicago a lot?
They do. It used to be the Central Division. Used to be like New Orleans, Minneapolis, St. Louis. You know, but more and more, it seems to be centering on Chicago. And I think the Palmer House is just an excellent venue.
Have they had it at the Palmer House before?
Yeah, yeah. Because
there's our philosopher fans out there. See,
look at that. The Michigan Avenue isn't crowded with people out there, listeners. We have to tell you, hey, there's a philosopher here. Yeah. They're just jamming the sidewalk.
But they have had it at the Palmer House before.
Oh yeah, yeah. Because there's so many rooms, so many breakout rooms, so many lecture theaters, it's a fantastic venue. It really is.
Before we say goodbye to you, you're a local guy.
You're going to say goodbye?
No. Born in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and yeah, tell me what your dad. I think it was fascinating that you were from Austin, then you moved to Lyle in 1955.
That's right.
Some other West Suburbanites out in the green room. Yeah,
right. My niece still and my sister and one of my nephews still live out in Naperville. My niece teaches in Lyle, a math teacher. We moved from there. My father was laid off. He was at Zenith. I often joke, my parents were such Southsiders. My father worked for Zenith, and I was 14 before I realized that word had an H in it. I worked at Zenith. Yeah, but you know, Dad was laid off, and a friend of his was starting another company downstate in a city called Peoria, Illinois. And so the family moved down there, and so I finished high school in Peoria, and then I joined the religious order, and they sent me to Europe, and that was pretty much. And then I did work in the ministry in Peoria for a few years.
So this was something you the spiritual, philosophical thing is something you wanted to follow from a young age.
Yeah, yeah, I would say so. Yeah. What's deeper? What's out there? What's personal? What's fundamental? these are philosophers' questions. I didn't know them at the time, but I remember going to one of my first philosophy classes, and we were comparing being and non-being. We were looking at the principle of causation and principles of contradiction, and looking at what one identity is, what my thoughts are not your thoughts. And I'm thinking, wow, when I was like four, I was thinking of this stuff, and I thought it was weird, but it is weird, but it's also philosophy.
Okay, we got 1 minute.
There you go.
Okay, 1 minute. I want you to tell me what's fundamental in 1 minute.
Existence. And if you want to put that in an ethical context, life and the protection and the sanctity of life. We're also looking at what's fundamental in right thinking is justice. I would say Excellent. Goodness, fairness. And these are the building blocks of our ethical principles.
It's easy to say that. It's hard to put that in practice sometimes.
Oh, is it ever?
Yeah.
But if it were easy, you know, it wouldn't be a challenge. It wouldn't be life.
Yeah.
As we know it.
Excellent. This worked out very well.
Dave, I'll see you at the Matchbox.
Yeah, I'll need a drink after this.
<I'll tell you. laughs>
Thank you to Dennis Kamlick, who gave us the lowdown on the American Philosophical Association Central Division 113th Annual Meeting. It just concluded today at the Palmer House Hilton Hotel.
Thank you.
So thanks a lot, Dennis.